teacher next week teaching, and we may be out a week. Keep you posted on that. Another thing that I wanted to mention is that God is pictured as a warrior here, very violent and manipulative. It's contrary to the way that we usually look at God today, and that's kind of, it hits us weirdly. We don't understand it. And so I ask the question, why would this be uplifting? And we're talking about a group of people who were slaves. They believed that when they went to battle, God went to battle with them. And in fact, if you think about it, we still pray today for military members. People pray for military victories. They pray for the safe return of troops. So it's not too unlike that. In fact, the Israelites were generally a weak military nation, starting as slaves, and then they got trod over by the Egyptians and the Assyrians and the Babylonians and other people, suffered defeats to the Philistines, to et cetera, et cetera. So it's not surprising that these people would have this view of God as a military warrior, as a great and mighty warrior with an outstretched arm going into battle with them. It would be a great comfort to them because they were fairly weak. And in that view then, though, other nations are evil. They're unfair. And specifically Egypt, throughout all of Scripture, is considered to be a relatively evil place. And so God doing things to Egypt would be fair and just in their mind. I also want to introduce you to the idea of liberation theology as it exists today, because it finds its roots and support here in this Exodus. It started in South America in the 1950s, slightly thereafter, and it's about economic equality. And it was a reaction to economic oppression, really, by various different groups. It's got ties to Marxism. The Catholic Church rejects it for that reason. But proponents of it say that the poor have the right to take what they deserve, what they need, by force to make it equal. So you have this same forceful taking, the same we're entitled to use violence to get our just deserts that you see here in Exodus. So it's not like a dead doctrine by any means. It's alive and well today, this view of God. So then I wanted to take a minute to talk about the historicity. And last week I gave a bad definition of historicity, I think. I said something to the effect of whether or not something really happened. A better definition is scientific inquiry into whether or not, into the details of an event, usually with the goal of determining whether or not something happened. But it's basically, what can archaeology tell us? What can anthropology tell us about an event? So I wanted to clarify that. So I always start with the literary. There are no literary parallels to the Exodus. Again, we're in novel ground. The one exception to that is you have Moses in the basket on the Nile River, and you have a story about Sargon of Akkad, or Akkadia, who also was put in a basket in a river, made the same way. But that's the only parallel. The names are Egyptian. Moses, Aaron, Well, yes, but I was trying to think of the, anyway, I'm losing a name, but all of the names are Egyptian to begin with. You have this question that Moses asks, so just talking about Moses for a second, who am I to stand up to Pharaoh? And people take that a lot of different ways. That's not what you would expect from Pharaoh's grandson or son, adopted son. It's kind of an interesting statement. So people wonder about whether or not Moses was, in fact, how he viewed his relationship with Pharaoh, I guess is the best way to put it. There's no mention in Egyptian records of a massive slave revolt like we would expect. However, ancient civilizations did not keep records of their losses, especially embarrassing ones like losing to a group of slaves. But we still think that this probably happened because escape from slavery in Egypt is a theme throughout the Bible, from the beginning to the end of the Old Testament. That is still the pivotal moment, and to have such an embedded ideology, you would think it would have to happen. It's embedded in Israel's legal history, with the Ten Commandments as being the foundation of the law. Those things are, if they didn't happen, would not be considered so important. There's no mentions of the plagues in Egypt. But again, that's not such a big surprise. There's no mention of Moses or Aaron. There's no evidence of 600,000 people wandering around the Sinai or anywhere else at that point in time. If you take 600,000 men, if you give them each a wife and two children, that puts the population over 2 million people, which is more than estimates of the entire population of Egypt at that time. An interesting note, though, is that the word for thousands is also the same word that you can use for a clan. So you could be talking about 600 clans, maybe, instead of 600,000 men. So people also point to some quote-unquote discrepancies in the accounts. In chapter 15, Miriam's song, one of the oldest parts of the Bible, as we best understand it. Songs are generally thought to be the oldest things, and then the story is built around the songs. This leaving of Egypt is described more as a sea battle, which is kind of an interesting twist on it, because that's not what we read in the narrative. So some people believe, based on these quote-unquote discrepancies, that there was a minor slave revolt in eastern Egypt where 600 slaves escaped. It is marshy land over there, and it would give credence to what's said in other places about chariots' wheels getting stuck in the mud. You'd think, oh, they escaped into the marsh and the wheels got stuck, and so they just said, oh, forget it. The small scale would not be reported, so that would be consistent with the reporting we saw earlier, but again, that's just people speculating.
I did do a lot of reading, too, that even though we don't have, like, physical evidence that it happened, and like Jay said, they really probably wouldn't have recorded any kind of loss. They were very braggy about all the people they brought in. One of the texts, like, I saw said that they, in one fell swoop, brought in 62,000 Iberu, which was, like, a working-class person. 62,000. So the Egyptians were very braggy about how many they brought in, but there's not a lot of records of how many they lost. But it wouldn't have been strange for people to flow, come in and out. Obviously, like, a large number of people leaving is pretty noteworthy. And then also, we do have records for the highland, in the highland area of Canaan, of around, I think it's like 1200 BCE, of Israelite settlements there, which would match the timeline that they traveled up and over into Canaan. So that was, I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, that's the latest they're dated,
yeah.
Which I wanted to get into is the big debate usually is over the when this occurred, right? So there's a pharaoh named Merneptah who ruled from 1213 to 1203 BC, and he left a stela, a rock, at the site of one of his victories and inscribed on it. And that's the first mention outside of the Bible of the Israelites as a people. He claims that he has had a military victory amongst about 11 or 12 other peoples over the Israelites. So that would be the absolute latest then that it could have happened, because they're there in Canaan when he leaves his stela. As we put it, sometime during the time of the judges, pre-King Saul is when this king lived, because Saul is usually dated to about 1050 BC, give or take. We talked about the Hyksos last week as a potential time period. Their reign in Egypt ended about 1532 BC. That's kind of the earliest that it could have happened. And that's what Josephus, the Jewish scholar from the first century BC, that's what he dated it to. We have mentions of cities built by Ramses and Seth. Those kings reigned between 1294 and 1213. That's from within the scripture itself. Using a reference in 1 Kings, it says, Saul, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign, which is about 966 BC, it was 480 years before that, and so that puts it around 1450, which is the date most people use when talking about it, just for convenience. And then I wanted to mention, that's during the reign of Amenhotep the second as pharaoh, but then I wanted to mention this one pharaoh, Akhenaten, who is he's in the 1300s, I forget exactly where. There's some weird historical coincidences that make me kind of wonder if he's the pharaoh that we're talking about. He was known to be militarily weak. He lost a significant number of outer territories, and if your entire army has been crushed, then you wouldn't have an army to fight with, and you'd lose that. I just thought that was weird. He pushed the worship of one god over over the traditional worship of Ra and the other Egyptian gods. And so it was a sun god still, but it was a different god, and that's kind of weird. His son was Tutankhamun. Well, his son or cousin or stepbrother, his heir, the king that came after him was Tutankhamun, that we all know, the child king that came to the throne at 8 years old. And Tutankhamun tried to erase all mention of Akhenaten. So that's kind of interesting, too, that if there had been this disastrous reign, that Tutankhamun would try to get rid of that evidence.
Akhenaten was considered a massive heretic because he overthrew the current religion, and so that would make a lot of sense then.
Yeah.
If people were like, this guy's crazy, destroy everything.
All right. So I think we can dive right into the scripture now itself instead of talking about the other things. So we start with oppression, right? Setting this story, we have a direct connection. It talks about Joseph dying and we dive right back into the Genesis narrative that we've been following, so it continues straight from that. We start referring to the people as Hebrews, which is, in the Old Testament, it's used of the patriarchs only as aliens in a foreign land. The other context when it's used is when we're talking about slaves. And Jenna mentioned the word Hebrew or Habiru or however you want to, it's spelled the same way as Hebrew. It's used of class divide in Egypt. We mentioned before that specifically it referred to mercenaries, but there was even a class divide between mercenaries and regular people. They were considered lower class and nasty. And so we jump into that. We see that the Hebrews aren't supposed to have male children. There's no word. We obviously know Moses made it through, but there's no word of how Aaron or any of the other people made it through. So we wonder how effective this ban was. And I point to that because this is the start of a view of an impotent king in Egypt. This is someone who is incompetent. They're making fun of him here, even though they're talking about the oppression of the Israelites. Specifically, kings were men. We're in a patriarchal society, which meant men rule over women. And one of the ways you illustrate a king was unworthy of his reign was to show how he could not control the women in his life. So we have Pharaoh is repeatedly outsmarted by women. First, we have the midwives who defy him and give a stupid explanation as to why they can't get there in time to kill male babies.
I think you need to read this explanation. It's great. It's great. My explanation in my translation, it says the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife can get to them. I just thought that was brilliant. They're vigorous women, and they give birth really fast.
Yeah. Pharaoh's own daughter brings a Hebrew baby. She knows he's a Hebrew. It says that here. Into his house. Wouldn't you like to be there for that conversation? Hey, Dad, I know you said kill all the Hebrew babies, but I found one in the river, and I'm gonna take it in, Dad. You know. And then you have Moses' sister and his mother arranging for the mother to get paid to take care of her own baby. Not only does she get to continue to have her baby, she gets paid to do it. What a beneficial situation. In fact, I want to point, though, to the women in Moses' life. They all save him, every single one of them, in this story that we're looking at today. The midwives allow him to be born. His mother makes the basket and cares for him. His sister makes sure he's safe on the river. Pharaoh's daughter rescues him from the river, and then his wife Zipporah, who will maybe mention later, I don't know how much we'll actually talk about her, rescues him from this mysterious attack by God. We have the burning bush moment, and then God attacks him, potentially because he's not circumcised or his son isn't circumcised, but his wife acts to save him in that. So we have this, every woman in Moses' life saving him. Anyway, back to Pharaoh. His plan also shows him to be unwise, right? You don't kill men to limit the future number of people that might revolt against you. People who are in charge of herds know this. The way you control the number of the herd is to slaughter female animals, not male animals. Israelites, who are herders by tradition up to this point, would know this. The theory here is, each female can only be pregnant once at a time, but if men can have any number of partners that can then produce as long as there are women to produce them, or male and female if we're talking about animals. So it's a stupid plan. showing once again that Pharaoh is kind of silly. And then the plan is also unwise because killing babies makes no sense when you fear revolt. It angers everyone. It gives a reason to revolt. Babies don't fight, so you would want to kill older people, not babies. And then it cuts off the source of your slave labor, which is what Egypt is dependent on at this point for their construction projects. So we have a silly pharaoh, silly king, putting up all kinds of ineffective oppression of the Israelites, making them serve and build bricks, and we know that they build at least these two cities. And let's turn to Moses then, because we get really into his story now. Just a couple of notes. You guys all know this story. His birth is, his name, Moses, is close to an uncommon Hebrew verb meaning to draw out or to lead out. It is the exact word that the Egyptians used to be born. So take from that what you will. We know it's an Egyptian name, but it may have Hebrew influences. He's put in a basket. Again, we mentioned before that this is the same word ark that's used of Noah's ark. It's probably a deliberate parallel to that story that we have the salvation of the people coming out of an ark, probably told in that way by the early Israelites. And Moses himself is described as good or beautiful, which may explain why Pharaoh's daughter, she sees this cute little baby in a basket on the river, and she's like, oh, I'm going to take him in because he's a beautiful little baby. We know nothing about his early life. In verse 10, he's a baby, and in verse 11, he's grown up. This is in chapter 2. He was probably educated in Pharaoh's court. He would know how to drive a chariot, how to wage war, which would serve him well potentially later as the leader of the Israelites. And he knows how to read and write, which explains how he would know how to write down the law. And he's mentioned, I think it's in 15 different places that he's writing something. He would be one of the very few people who knew how to read and write. And he also knew that he was a Hebrew. So then he grows up, and in the brashness of his youth, he's demanding change. He realizes the injustice. I kind of think of him as like a French revolutionary. Obviously in the French Revolution, one of the students that they're, you know, that we read about or see in Les Mis or something, that, you know, he's standing up for what's right and doing what's right, and he ends up killing a man. Some people say he was about 17. Some people say that he was 40. That's what we find over in Acts and Stephen's speech before the Sanhedrin. Which if he's 40 when he does this, he's already lived a long life. But it kind of separates his life into three chapters. He'd have like the early life in Egypt, which is the first 40 years. Then we know when he comes back from Midian, he's 80 years old, so the second set. And we know he dies at 120 years old. So it's kind of three sets of 40 if we look at it that way. Anyway, he kills the man, and he's forced to flee in his own mind that he won't be forgiven, and he goes to Midian, which is in the Sinai Peninsula, basically, and he meets a man named Jethro, who is a priest, and according to the prior genealogies we have, he easily could have been a priest of the same God that he already knows as a Hebrew, so, and that would be a people that he's comfortable with as well, so... With that, we then turn to the burning bush.
Yes. So the text says, meanwhile, Moses was shepherd. Oh, so right before this, in the end of chapter 2, it specifically says that the Pharaoh of Egypt dies, and that the Israelites groaned because of their difficult labor, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of the difficult labor ascended to God, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and with Jacob, and God saw. God saw the Israelites, and God knew. So it says in chapter 3, meanwhile, Moses was shepherding the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led the flock away to the mountain of God. Then an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire within a bush. And the text specifically says that he noticed it. Mine says he looked and saw that the bush was on fire but not consumed. Moses thought, I must go over and look at this remarkable sight. Why isn't the bush burning up? And John Wesley's commentary specifically suggests that if Moses had not noticed the bush, God wouldn't have called him at all. So I thought that was a really interesting teaching moment. Travis is looking at me funny, but I've heard this many other places as well. Fight me, Travis. Anyway, but so I think that's an interesting teaching moment that God puts things he looks and he goes over and God calls to him, Moses, Moses, here I am, he answers. And then God specifically instructs him to remove his sandals from his feet, for the ground on which you stand is holy. And this would have been the cultural equivalent of asking someone to take their hat off while they pray. It's a sign of respect and submission. And so God introduces himself as the God of your father, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Moses hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. And Jay, did you see any commentaries that talked about the discrepancy between it saying that it was an angel of the Lord and then in this part it specifically says that it's God? Did you see anything about that?
No, not in particular. Yeah. Some people point to the angel as being a messenger, of course, and that this is a messenger appearing, but no one really took issue with it that I read. They were just kind of saying somehow the Lord appeared.
Yeah, that's what I saw too. Just kind of commenting on it. At first it says it's an angel, and then it's God, and then they move on. Then we find that God has seen the oppression of the Israelites, and this really goes back to our Genesis theme that God sees us. And also, he's looking for a partner to bring them out of Egypt, going back to our new theme of God, of us doing things in God's presence and of us co-laboring with God, because God could have just brought the Egyptians out by himself. He didn't need anyone to do it for him, but he chose to have someone do it with him. So I think that's really significant. And so this exchange between Moses and God is very famous. In verse 11, it says, but Moses asked God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Like Jay said earlier, we're not really sure what his relationship was to Pharaoh, if he was confident before him or not. Well, obviously he's not confident before him. But God answers him, I will certainly be with you. And this will be the sign to you that I am the one who sent you. When you bring the people out of Egypt, you will all worship God at this mountain. And I think this is super significant because when faced with the self-doubt of Moses, God's immediate response is to assure him of his presence, which I think that we can all relate to because all of us have been filled with self-doubt at some point. But God's response is always to assure us of his presence. And then also this is significant too because it shows us that God brings us out of places for us to worship him. And so that's the whole point of why God brought them out of Israel, is because he saw their oppression and he wanted to bring them into a good place. And so then we get down to this exchange in verse 14 where Moses says, if I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What should I tell them? And it says in verse 14, God replied to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent you. And this is what we call the tetragrammaton.
Tetragrammaton. Means four letters.
Yes, it's the YHWH. It's four. Tetragrammaton means word with four letters in it. And so I read a lot of really interesting things about this phrase, I am that I am. It's Eyeh Asher Eyeh. And it, Hebrew, ironically, doesn't distinguish between the present tense and the future tense. So it can mean I am that I am. It can mean I will be what I will be. It could also mean I will create what I will create. But the main focus of this is being. And many scholars believe that the main focus of this is being, that God specifically can bring things into being. For example, he can bring a nation into being out of a band of runaway slaves. And something also interesting that I read is that some scholars believe that this is God's way of evading the question. He says, who are you? And he says, I am who I am. Next question.
We've kind of touched on that before. Like, he doesn't give a real name. He kind of gives, this is what you can tell him.
Exactly. So it's maybe the name of God, maybe not the name of God. Because I know in this class we have talked about how names had power. And if you knew the name of something, you had power over it. So if you look at it in that case, in that sense, it would make sense that God really wouldn't want people to know his name, culturally at least, even for just the cultural significance. So maybe this is him evading the question. It's also thought that this could be a promise. I will be what I will be to you. It's a promise of God's presence, that he will be with them in every step of their journey. And even at the beginning of Deuteronomy, actually, God specifically says, I have been with you. I have been with you every day these past 40 years. So it very well may have been a promise that he was going to be with them. But at the very least, it's a statement of his self-sufficiency, his eternal and unchanging nature, and a statement of faithfulness. big I am that I am, I will be what I will be, must have been very frightening. And so God does follow this title up with, but I am the God of your fathers, which I think is like a, I'm big and scary and you can't 100% know me, but you also know me because I'm the God of your fathers. So I thought that was very sweet.
If I can jump in for just a second, I wanted to say something about this. I am the God of your fathers. Because as I was looking at things, I found some really interesting information. Between about 1550 BC and 1200 BC, the same time we're talking about here with this, we see throughout the world a shift in who these different peoples worship. Babylon, you have Marduk taking over for Anu. You have in Greece, you have Cronus supplanted by Zeus at about this point in time. In the Hittite religion, you have this god Kumarbi supplanted by one called Teshub. In India, you have Deus replaced by Indra. And even in Canaanite religion, you have El replaced with Baal about the same time. And so it's really interesting that we have this god stepping forward and saying, I am the same God that you've known all along. I'm the God that was here for Abraham and everyone else before you, that everyone knows. I'm the same one. I'm giving you a name, but I'm the same, or a title, or a
whatever
description. But I'm the same God that you've already known. And it's really interesting in a time where all of these other ones are having God supplanted by other gods. So I just thought that was kind of interesting.
I think it's also very interesting. And then we have the exchange where God even tells them that when they leave in Egypt, they will not go empty-handed. And I think it's really interesting that he promises Moses that they'll have abundant provision. So I think, that's it for burning bush.
Yeah, and as you move forward, it's interesting because, you know, Moses has just now seen a burning but not consumed bush, a God who is speaking to him, yet he still has plenty of excuses. That's kind of my big takeaway from the story of early Moses, is that he's a man full of reasons why I'm not right for this.
Well, it gives me a question. When we have, what are our burning bush moments, first of all, in our lives today? And then how do we react then when we have those burning bush moments? When it's us and God, there's no one else around, so we're not worried about kind of loving others and being in relationship with others. But what do we do when it's just God and us? Face to face. Sorry to interrupt.
And no, as Moses is face to face with God, and God has told him, you're going to go free these people. Here's who you tell them is freeing him. He says, but what if they don't believe me? They're not going to believe that you showed up to me. So God gives him basically a utility belt of miracles. You know, he can throw the staff on the ground. It turns into a snake. He picks it up. It's a staff again. He puts his hand into his cloak. He takes it out. It's leprous, or you know, so full of leprosy that it looks like snow, the script says. And then the next portion, which is that if those two signs are not believed, if he takes water from the Nile and pours it on the ground, it will become blood on the ground. But even with God giving him this okay, you can do all three of these miracles, which are all, interestingly enough, kind of foreshadowing different things that are going to come up to Egypt later, Moses says, okay, but I can't speak very well. I'm not a good speaker. And some scholars believe he had a speech impediment, you know, that there was something wrong with his ability to speak. But again, God responds, who's made the mouth? Who's made the ears? You know, I'm the one in charge of all of these things. And that's not good enough for Moses. So Moses says, but please, can't you just find somebody else to do it? So God then says, fine, we'll take your brother Aaron, and he will speak to you, and you will be, the interesting portion is, you shall be as God to him. And I think, as I've been reading that and kind of studying that, the significance that I saw was not, you shall lord over him, but more so, you shall speak to him in the same way that I'm speaking to you, and then he'll speak to the people, almost like God to the prophets often was. So Moses returns to Egypt, and as he goes back, he tells his family, the people in Midian that he'd been staying with, that he will leave. And God says to go to Pharaoh and tell him, Israel is my firstborn son, and I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. So one of the takeaways as we get further into this book is that God gives pretty ample time for people to follow his requests. So all the way in chapter 4, long before the firstborn sons end up getting killed, Moses is telling Pharaoh, get right, or, you know, I'm going to cut down yours. So, and again, another significance here, if you look at it Christologically, is Israel's the firstborn. Jesus was the firstborn. There's a significance there that God says, this firstborn is mine. These are my people. Also, as a firstborn, it's terrifying because there seems to be a lot of pressure put on firstborns. But they go back, and as he tells Pharaoh, you know, let my people go, Pharaoh says no, and in fact, I'm going to oppress them more. They no longer get straw for their bricks, but they have to make just as many bricks, and we're going to beat them and whip them. And if you want to look at this and to have something to take away from the Egyptian side, it's that don't oppress people. It's a bad thing to do, and more oppression is also bad. So, you know, if you want to have a takeaway from what should you learn from the Egyptians, it's don't oppress people, especially don't oppress God's people, because then God, so as they're further oppressed, Moses and the rest of the Israelites just become even more gripey and complainy, as Moses has said, hey, I'm going to lead you out, and Pharaoh says, I don't think so. And the Israelites go, why did you tell Pharaoh you were going to lead us out? Now he's even more oppressive to us. But God hears that, and rather than responding with anger or disappointment, he reassures them again and says, I promise you, I'm leading you out of this, and I'm leading you into redemption.
Yeah. God, this whole process, God is very forthright about what he is going to do. As Mitchell says, he literally tells them, like, that there's going to be a smiting of the firstborn if they don't let people go. He's very forthright, and it's very interesting to see how people respond to that, which I think is very significant for our lives, because oftentimes we want to know what's going to happen, but I think this really shows us that even if we did know what was going to happen, that really wouldn't help us at all.
This promise that he gives is also the promise to return to the land. It's not just you're going to be free. It's you're going to have a place. You're going to have this land that I promised to your father. So it's a reaffirmation of the earlier covenant already. And it's also interesting that, again, we're tying the Israelite people with the land. This group of people have land. So, and then it kind of turns to this random genealogy. And we've talked about genealogies a bit before. But I just wanted to say two things real quick. Lists only matter if the things listed matter, right? And so you wouldn't have a genealogy if these weren't important for some reason. And I started thinking through it this time, and I'm thinking, what would my genealogy look like? And I'm not talking about a list of just names, but I'm thinking about the people who have influenced us. You know, if you just took the first 6 years of your life and you tried to list everything that was important to you during that time, of course you'd have parents and family members, kindergarten teachers, preschool teachers, you'd have a lot of events wrapped up in these names. And I think that's really what they're trying to do is try to bring in a whole picture of who Moses is at this point in time. I wanted to say a quick note about Aaron. Mitchell already mentioned a couple of things. I wanted to mention with this, you'll be as God to him. This is the first time we've spent all of Genesis having this distinction between man and God. Like, the two are separate, and when man tries to be like God, that's a bad thing. But here you have God saying, you are going to be like God in this instance. And I just thought that was kind of interesting that they're confusing this nature between the two. And then the other thing I want to mention is this, you have this rising prominence, and this is one of the reasons that people tend to think that this was done in the 6th century, 5th century BC, is because you have this rising importance of a Levite, of the priesthood. You have Aaron delivering the promise of freedom to the people, not Moses himself. When you go and you have the plague narratives here, Aaron is the active person in several of them rather than Moses. So you have this kind of interesting, hey, we're the Levites that probably put this together, the priests that put this together, and hey, we're going to give a little bit of attention to Aaron here. So I just thought that's kind of an interesting thing. All right, back to Moses and the plagues, though, because, yeah, and I have about 1 minute of content here, because we all know the plagues, right? Bad things happen. So I just wanted to point out a couple of things. After the fourth plague, Pharaoh offers a compromise. Moses has said, we need to go and offer sacrifices, and Pharaoh says, well, the men can go and worship out in the desert. You can take all the men and go worship. This is kind of negotiation as usual in the Old Testament or in the ancient world. It allows Pharaoh to keep some leverage. Hey, they'll return. They'll come back to slavery. They can go worship and do what they want for a little bit. But then they have to come back because they want their wives and children. And Moses says, no, it has to be everyone. This is inclusive. Our young, our old, our men, our women, our children, everyone needs to be a part of this. And so we see that I like to look at this as kind of saying, well, this is, we're talking about the people of God here, that this is a very inclusive people of God. And then I also wanted to take a quick note to talk about the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. And we already mentioned that we see God as a warrior God in this. So after the sixth plague, instead of Pharaoh hardening his own heart, he says, that God did it. And so God hardened Pharaoh's heart. So we have to ask, how can a good God do this if we believe God is good? And again, I point to the history of the Israelite people and their war, that they've been in slavery, and that Egypt is really getting what it deserves in their mind. The entirety of Egypt kept Israel as slaves, so the entirety of the people deserve to have the plague on them. I would say it's probably a mistake to look for subtle ethical principles in that. I think that this is a pretty clear case of, we're talking about kind of Israel, God's revenge on Israel at this point for this. It's a more simplistic division than we can otherwise have. It's Israel, the people of God, and others, anyone who stands in the way of them. Because Yahweh is the God of Israel, he's on the side of his people and isn't concerned here with those other people. So I would say that.
Another note that I would make about the plagues, just minor note, is that each of these plagues did represent one of the Egyptian gods. And you might take that as God showing his might over these Egyptian gods, and I think that's fair, but I think it's also a reminder to Israel, who's now been in captivity for a generation or so, that, okay, I know you've been hearing about all these other gods. I know that these are the things that you've been asked to worship and everything else. No, I'm the God over these gods. Yeah.
So you have in chapter 12, verse 13, he says, I turned one page too far. He says, I will bring judgment on the gods of Egypt, anyway, is what it gets down to. And that's where this argument that each of the plagues is directed against a specific Egyptian god comes from. And it's most noticeable in the ninth plague, the darkness. This would be a direct assault on Ra, right, under this theory. Ra is the sun god. The pharaoh is, in Egyptian legend, the son of Ra. And so you've got this direct assault. I've created darkness. Look at what I can do to Ra. So anyway, with that, let's turn over to what happens after that ninth plague and the firstborn and the Passover and such.
So the last and final plague, which has been warned a couple times to the Egyptians, is I'm going to kill your firstborn. And finally, the threat is made and it says, hey, at this hour, more specifically, around midnight, which I thought was interesting that it says somewhere in the middle of the night. You're not going to know exactly, but that the angel of the Lord was going to pass over, which is where you then get the Passover from, and kill the firstborns of everybody, all living, you know, things in the area. It was not just something that was a threat to the Egyptians. This was a threat to the Israelites if they did not then follow what God asks them to do after, which is to take the blood of the lamb, paint it over their doorpost, and that would then be assigned to the angel of the Lord to pass over them and leave them be. And obviously there's a Christological parallel, as Jesus is the lamb and the blood of the lamb, which is then put onto us, is what allows, you know, God's judgment to pass over us. And a couple notes that we had from that was that also when you look at the act of Passover that then continues on with, you know, the celebration and the feast and the taking of cups, in Luke there's this, the telling of communion, that the first communion that they take, and they take one cup and then they take the bread and then they take the cup again, and it's a little different than the others. The cup that Jesus takes and says, this is me, that was the third cup of Passover, which represented redemption. And so when Jesus passes that to his disciples, it's not just the representation that this is my blood, which saved you. It's this, the redemption cup, that's me.
Yeah. We also have a fourth cup, which is the cup of wrath. And this is the cup that in the
12, which is where we're ending today, God gives kind of some instruction for who should take Passover. This is the statute of Passover. No foreigner shall eat of it, but every slave that is bought for money may eat of it after you have circumcised him. So this whole thing basically says, this is a covenant for me and my people. Nobody else gets to partake of this covenant between me and my people, except if you bring them into the fold. So from the beginning, there's a significance for God to make covenants and to have sacraments with his people, and to differentiate that from any promises that he makes to everyone. But at the same time, there's no one who can't then join that family and join that covenant and fold. I think sometimes we have this idea that, oh, there was Israel, and they were the only ones of God's people and the only ones he really protected and cared about. But if you really look at it, anybody could have joined Israel at any time and gotten to partake of those things.
So that's the Passover, and then we kind of sort of, we do get into the Exodus a little bit. And God falls through on his promise that he made in chapter 3 that they would not go empty-handed, and they are instructed to go and get gold and silver from their oppressors, their masters. And Mitchell and I had a really interesting conversation about this, wondering if this was a biblical case for slavery reparations, specifically in the United States. So after the slaves were freed at the end of the Civil War, there was a specific law that was passed, or wasn't quite passed, but that made it pretty far in the bill process. And it said that male slaves were to receive 40 acres of land. Yeah, 40 acres and a mule of land. And then President Van Buren came in and cut the law down. And so Mitchell and I had a really interesting conversation about if this was a biblical argument, that was wrong.
Well, specifically because not only do the Israelites go and say, hey, you know, give us your gold and silver, the Egyptians go, yeah, that's fair, and they give them the gold and silver. And even as these people are rebelling and leaving, the everyday Egyptian people feel some sort of, you know, oh, okay, yeah, we've made these people our slaves for a long time now. Here's your point.
Yeah, I would argue that they're not worried about how they've made them feel. I'm thinking they're like, we've had such terrible things going after, like the wheat has been destroyed, the herds have been destroyed. Get out of here. Take it and go. We don't want you here. You know, I would say it's more of an expediency than a feel bad.
And even Pharaoh says, go get out, but bless me first. So Pharaoh's son has just died, and all he is really concerned about is being blessed in his own life. So not a good guy, guys. Not a good guy. It's bad.
All right.
I think we're done.
Yeah, and with that, next week we may or may not have class, depending on what we find out about. There will be class. It may be us talking about the next part of Exodus, or it may be a guest teacher talking about whatever he wants to talk about. So it's one of the potential.